Welcome to the final lecture on quantitative research. And some of you commented before that the content is difficult and it's particular so because the teaching language is English. And I was thinking that before the exam, we could do a one session where you get to ask questions and I will explain these concepts to you in Finnish or English. If you want to do that, I'll send you an email about it after the class. And then if there's sufficient interest, then we'll organize a time for 2 hours where you get to ask questions and I'll go through the slides and answer the questions in either English or Finnish, depending on which one you prefer. Let's get now started on this lecture. So we have altogether 4 lectures on quantitative research. And quantitative research was research done with numbers instead of research done with text or video or some other qualitative non-numerical data. The 3 important things about doing research with numbers is, first, what do we want to say with the numbers? Are we just describing something like failure rates in exam scores? Are we trying to predict something? Do we want to make a predictive model, for example, on who is going to default on their loans, who's going to pay their loans on time, or do we want to explain why something happens? For example, do we explaining why some students perform better in the class than others? So these are the 3 main questions that we can do with numbers. The second thing about quantitative research was, where do we get the numbers? And that relates to research design. Singleton and Straits talk about 4 different prototypical designs: experimented laboratory, survey, which is asking people, field study, which is observing people, and archival data, which refers to using data that someone else has collected for you, for example, government databases. And we covered 3 topics this far. We talked about generally what can we say with numbers in the first lecture. We talked about statistical inference, which refers to ruling out chance as an explanation for a finding, and we used the p-value for that. Lecture 2 was about measurement. How do we quantify things that are not directly available for us as numbers? So how do we quantify information system development success, for example? And then last lecture, we talked about regression analysis, which is the main tool that we use when we want to say something with the numbers. So regression analysis was a statistical technique that is like a correlation, so it quantifies how strongly variables are linearly associated, but instead of just 2 variables, which is the correlation, we have 1 dependent variable and 1 or more independent variables. And the regression analysis answers which one of these independent variables that we have in the model actually matter in explaining the dependent variable. So it allows us to test for correlation, taking alternative explanations into account. Today, we're going to be taking this all together. We're going to be talking about doing quantitative research in practice. So what do you actually have to do if you write your master's thesis using quantitative techniques? And then we'll go through a practical data analysis and a data collection task that I have done before. So I'll show you what the analysis looks like and how I would interpret the results. And then we have a few concluding words. So now we're going to be addressing what do you need to write in your master's thesis, or if you want to be a researcher in your research paper, when you use quantitative techniques. And quantitative papers, or any other research paper generally, follow a particular structure. For quantitative work, the structure is more rigorously followed than for qualitative work, where there's more freedom in how you explain your methods and results, for example. And the structure in any master's thesis or any research paper or any good research report follows this kind of... First, you start with an introduction. So the important part in introduction is you have to say 2 things. 1, what are you doing in your study? And why is it important to do? So the idea of the purpose of an introduction in a paper or in a master's thesis is to get the reader's interest. So the reader, when they read a good introduction, it should be, they should not spend but a few minutes on it, and then they should be interested in learning more. So the idea of introduction is kind of like an advertisement of your work, and the main point is to make the reader to go through the entire thing. Then we go through the literature review, and literature review can have different subsections. Typically, because in quantitative research, we always start with some kind of theory that we then test. The literature review is the part where you develop your theory. So you go through existing explanations. For example, if you are studying what causes some information systems development projects to be more successful than others, then you go through what kind of explanation have been provided for this phenomenon. You write about it, and then you maybe propose some other theory, and then you state some hypotheses that you should observe if the theory is correct. For example, if we say that there is this saying that adding more people to a development project that is late will make it more late. So then we could make a hypothesis that increase in personnel number in late projects is associated with the project being more late, for example. So you state a statistical association there that you should observe if the theory is correct. Important part about theory is that hypothesis in and itself is not a theory. So a theory is an explanation of what happens, how, when, and particularly why. So the why part is the most challenging to explain because it really requires that you think through the theory. It's easy to say that participating in class causes you to be more successful in the exam. It's more difficult to explain why that is the case. So the why question is the most important part in theory, and it's also the hardest part. Then we have, after the hypothesis, we have data and methods. I'm going to talk more about that on the next slide, but that basically explains what you did in the study. Then you have the results section where you present the results of your statistical analysis. Basically, you just report which hypothesis was supported and which one was not. In the results part, you don't yet explain what the results mean. You just explain these are the results. Then you have a discussion section where you reflect on the results. So you tell the reader, what do these results actually mean? So there's a difference in level of abstraction. And then in the conclusions, you say, you briefly summarize what you did, what you found, and why is the study interesting. Or if your study is completely uninteresting, you can say that as well. My former colleague used to use this term called master's thesis wave, and he was using this to present the level of abstraction. So in the introduction, you are working on a very abstract level. So you don't really say much about the specifics of your study. You just talk about the phenomenon. Then when you go to the data and methods, then you talk about things that are specific to your study and maybe nothing else. And then again, when you go to the conclusions, you increase the level of abstraction. So here you talk about what generally do your results mean for the society or for science or for whoever you like to inform. The data and methods typically follows also a certain structure. We have four important components in the data and methods. So we have first the sample. What are the units that you're studying? What is the unit of analysis? And is it students? Is it development teams? Is it companies? Is it information system products? Is it something else? So what is, if you think of your data as an Excel sheet, the sample explains what are the rows in your Excel sheet. Also, the sample explains the population. So what is the general? If we are talking about, let's say, student sample. So is it all students in this university? So what is the population to which you want to generalize? If we take this class as a sample, it could be a sample of students from those students that participate this course. or it could be a sample of students from the entire university, or it could be a sample of people living in Finland, for example. So we have to state what is the population and how do we come up with a smaller sample to study. Then the next one is measures. So how do we measure the concepts that we are interested in? Sometimes if we are interested in return on assets, like in the example that I'll be using, then that's a number directly, so we don't have to measure it. If we are interested in information system success, for example, then that's we have to figure out a way to quantify that. So here in the measures subsection, you explain what are the key constructs or concepts that you study and how each of those are measured. We also assess reliability and validity there. Then comes data collection or procedures. If you have something that is more complicated, like if you do an experimental study with some experimental procedures, then this is the place to explain it. If you do a survey, then you could just tell in the measures section that these were done in a survey study. So depending on how complex your research design is, dictates whether you need a separate data collection. And same for analysis. If you are doing something very basic, like regression analysis, then you don't need to have a section about analysis necessarily in a paper. In a master's thesis, it's always a good idea to have a separate part, section, where you explain your analysis, because then we can verify that you have understood what the analysis is about. So, and these map to the research process, and sample directly to sampling, measures directly to measures, data collection directly to data collection, and analysis goes to the data analysis and interpretation. Now, preparation of research design and data processing are not here. Data processing is not here in the structure because that's a mechanical activity. Like, how do you screen for outliers? How do you merge two data sets? That's mechanics, and it doesn't need to be explained. Preparation of research design is not here because research design is the thing that encompasses all of this. So you don't have to necessarily explain how you prepared your research. You have to explain what is the outcome. We can compare this prototypical structure to what was presented in the Venkatesh's paper. And their paper starts with the introduction compared to introduction in our structure. Then they have two sections. They have a theoretical foundation and model development. And we have here literature review. Now, it's sometimes this kind of the literature review is separated into two subsections. And it's fairly common to do that kind of thing in a master's thesis as well. If you have two subsections, the first subsection is usually generally about what does the literature say generally about the phenomena that you're studying. And that's what Venkatesh and colleagues do. Then the second part is about the specific theory and hypothesis that you're testing. So that's a very common way. Another common way is just to have one section called literature review or maybe theory and hypothesis and or something like that. But the important part is that you have hypotheses that are based on theory. Then they have a section called methods. We have data and methods. So it's the same, just named a bit differently. And they explain research context, sample and procedures and measures. We can see that the sample and procedures here contains the sample information and data collection information. The reason why they are having just one section instead of two sections is that they're just doing a survey, and that's pretty basic. So nothing advanced, so no need to have a separate subsection on it. In master's thesis, I would recommend that you always have these four subsections because you have space to explain your data collection technique in more detail. In articles, you're always space constrained because an article should be less than 30 pages or so. Then they have research context that is lacking here, and some articles have this research context that explains generally about the research design. Others don't, so that's an optional component. I would say that in a master's thesis, you can have data and methods section, have one paragraph that explains what you do and then explain the specifics. But it's not necessarily have this kind of a separate section here. Then they have measures, which is the same here, and they don't have analysis because they just apply regression analysis, which is a very basic technique, and it is assumed that all readers of information systems research know what regression analysis is, so there's no need to explain it. In a master's thesis where you have to demonstrate that you understand what you're doing, I recommend that you always have a separate section on data analysis, and most master's theses that I've read actually do. Okay, so that's about the structure of the paper. Any questions or structure of master's thesis? So once you have your results, then you are 80% done in quantitative study. So you just then put everything into this kind of structure, and then you submit your study. And that's when you're done. Okay, so if you are 80% done once you have the results, then we next ask the question, okay, how do I get the results? So to get statistical results or quantitative analysis results, you first of all need a statistical software. And how many of you have ever used Excel? Are there really some people who have never used Excel? Excel, yeah. So everyone has used Excel, and Excel contains some tools for very basic statistical analysis. But you're going to be shooting yourself in the foot really hard if you're trying to use Excel for a master's thesis. And I have never seen a successful master's thesis that would have done regression and correlation analysis using Excel, and you can't even do factor analysis. It's doable, but it's very difficult to do correctly compared to how you can do these analysis with statistical software. So you can't use Excel really practically. So the first question when you have some data is which software should I use? And does any one of you have any experience on any statistical software? A few. Which software have you used? SPSS. How about you?
SPSS.
Yeah, and that's the most common software. And the three software that people who start analyzing data now, the three software that they use are SPSS, Stata, and R. There are also others that are commonly used, but those are mainly used by old people who learned the software in the 80s or 70s and never wanted to learn something more modern. So SPSS, Stata, and R are the most commonly used ones. When you choose a software, there are certain things that you can consider. And SPSS and Stata and R, they're all command-driven statistical software. So how do these software differ from Excel? And in Excel, you specify, you have your data, each number is in a cell, and then you analyze the data by specifying worksheet formulas to other cells. So you have this kind of cell structure where some cells contain data and some cells contain some kind of statistics calculated from those data, such as means and standard deviations and minimums and maximums and things like that. So in Excel, you're working with one file and there is no really logical structure to the file except that it has rows and columns. In statistical software, the approach is slightly different. So you have at least two files. You have your analysis file, and then you have your data file. And the analysis file specifies what you do with the data, and data file is something that you don't ever edit yourself. And that's an advantage, because in an Excel sheet, it's possible that you accidentally delete a cell of your data and you don't realize, or you accidentally modify your data. In statistical software, when the data is in a separate file, then the chances of you accidentally modifying it is less. So these are also command-driven, which means that when you have an analysis file or if you have an analysis log or whatever file that it is that you save your analysis in or results in, it's command-driven. So you execute command sequence. For example, you have regression analysis 1, then 2, then 3, then correlation table, and then some kind of graphic. And the software will calculate those in exact same order. The advantage of that is that it's easy to follow what is your logic, and you can also write comments to your analysis file explaining to yourself and documenting what you did. So how many of you have ever done any programming? Out of you, how many of you think comments are important in your code? Yeah. Same here. When you have an analysis file, whether you type it yourself, you can type it or you can do it by point and click, it's important to have comments there. Then we have, these are designed for different audiences. SPSS is designed for corporate use, so it's mainly for marketing departments, and the pricing reflects that, so it's fairly expensive software. And it's also easy to use for basic tasks. So it's aimed for people with very little knowledge and to get some things done, which I think most of you qualify. Then STATA is designed for professional researchers. It's not more difficult to use than SPSS, but it's a lot more powerful. Then R is designed to be general, so it's more like a programming language. Then we have SPSS documentation explains how you get things done with SPSS, and that's something you normally want to do, get things done with your statistical software if you write a master's thesis. STATA explains the analysis, so it explains the statistical theory, and then it explains what you can do with the analysis. So the documentation is a lot deeper, but for a master's thesis worker, it's probably not big of a difference. If you want to be a professional researcher, that's a very big advantage for STATA. Then R documentation explains the R syntax, and then you would have to get a good book on how you actually apply the analysis. So R documentation is not a very user-friendly. Availability on these SPSS, I think it's available for all, on all computers owned by the university. Then you can also install it on your own computer. And STATA, we have Asia Africa computer class. We have STATA there through the business school. Then R is installed on all computers because it's a free software, open source. So SPSS, if you want to own it so that you can use it after your studies, it costs you 30 euros. Otherwise, you get an annual license that you have to reapply. So you can get it for free or get it with a bit better conditions for 30 euros. Then student version of STATA starts at $38, and R is free and open source. So that's the consideration. You can use these in three different ways. You can use menus, so point and click. And like in an Excel sheet, when you use Excel, and you want to calculate average of two numbers, you can do it by clicking on the functions, worksheet function, browse to the average, then click the two cells, and then click OK, and it calculates you the average. Or you can just click on the cell where you want the average calculated and type average parentheses and the cell indices there. So in statistical software, you can do the same. So you can use menus, point and click. It's good if you don't know what you're doing, because point and click can't get you really wrong. And then, but once you know what you're doing, then it's a lot quicker to just type the average in the worksheet formula instead of going through the menus. And then you have the command file that is just a sequence of all the commands. Ideally, you would, at the end of your master's thesis project, you would have a command file that takes all your data and calculates all the analysis that you did. All this software support that kind of workflow. So there are three different ways. Now, what do the software look like? And SPSS looks like that. So you have many windows, and you have your data window here in the background, which looks like an Excel sheet, but you can't edit it. So it's just static data. That's the you can't type worksheet formulas here like you can in an Excel. Then you have a separate window that shows your analysis results. So it's a good structure if you're working with one data set. But for example, if you have two data sets open at the same time, it's difficult to know which data you're actually analyzing when you do something in this analysis window. And we can see here that it's a sequence, so commands executed in sequence. We have regression analysis here, and then some kind of analysis that are typically done when you do a regress. Stata, main window looks like that. So the main difference in Stata, main window, is that you don't see your data, because it's usually not a productive use of your time to look at the numbers. It's much more productive to look at correlations, means, and standard deviations. So Stata, you can type commands, or you can do menus here. In SPSS, you can only do menus. You can't type directly. You can type to an analysis file, but you can't type commands and just execute them as they are. Then you have some information about the data, and you have a log of what you did. So the SPSS, here's the log, here's the output. In Stata, here's the log, here's the output. Another difference is that Stata formats your output as text, and SPSS formats your output as HTML. So copy-pasting from, if you want to copy-paste directly to your paper, then copy-pasting from SPSS is slightly easier than copy-pasting from Stata. Then R is a programming language, and you have to have an editor to use R. And the R's built-in editor is pretty bad, but there is a good editor called RStudio. The difference between RStudio and SPSS and Stata is that RStudio only allows you to type commands or work on an analysis file. So there is no menu structure, so you can't calculate. Whereas in Stata and SPSS, you can just click on the statistics menu and choose regression model, and then it'll do regression with point and click. In R, you have to know that you have to type LM parentheses, then the dependent variable tilde, then the independent variable separated by plus, and then end parentheses to calculate the regression analysis. So you have to know how to type the commands. So you basically need a book, so you can't just take the software and start using it. There is a learning curve. So which one of these is the best? And I use Stata and R because those are meant for professional researchers. And I work a bit faster with Stata. But for some things, R, because it's a programming language, is more flexible. So some things that are more advanced, I may use R. I don't use SPSS because I find that to be limited from a professional researcher perspective. Researchers that I know mainly use SPSS or Stata. And I know quite a few people, including my wife, who is an SPSS user, and says that she really would like to use something else. But then trying to learn something else takes a couple of months easily. And then that's time that you're not doing productive research. Use of R is increasing. So people who are now early career just starting research are picking up R at the increasing pace because it's available always. So when I came here, I came from a university where we use Stata. And then getting Stata here was a non-standard thing, so I had to apply it for separately. With R, it's always available. So that's one reason why people use it. Then students at here mainly use SPSS and R. I have not seen a single master's thesis here written using Stata. The reason for that is, I think, that availability. So Stata is only in one computer lab. And before the business school moved in, it wasn't even available there, even though it's the best out of these for applied researchers. So we have a site license, and you're going to be fine with SPSS. Just if you want to do a research career, then using something else is probably a better option. Some students in my postgraduate courses tend to use Stata and R because they are looking for a tool that they are not using for a master's thesis only, but using for the next 30 years or so, how long their career is going to be. So that's the consideration. If you want to install SPSS, it's available here, and most stuff here can help you with how to use SPSS. If you require help with Stata or R, then not everyone can help you. Any questions about statistical software? Let's now go through a real-world data analysis example and take all this thing that we have covered together. So what is the first step in a quantitative research project? So what's the first thing that we need to do? No, data collection is not the first thing. Topic, yeah. We start with a research topic. And then based on research topic, what do we do? So let's say that we want to study information system success. What do we do then? What's the second step? Yeah, then we go and we see what have others written about it, what are the leading theories on that explain why some information systems projects are more successful than others. What's the next step after we have a theory? Yeah, then we specify hypothesis what we should observe if the theory that we are testing is correct. And the hypothesis is the part that we can actually test. So we can't test directly information system success because it's an unobservable concept. So we have to have a hypothesis of something, some two or more variables that we can measure. And after we have a hypothesis, then we can start to think about the empirical research design. Working with the literature review in quantitative or qualitative or constructive research is about the same, so there is no large differences. These approaches really start to diverge at forming of the hypothesis. So we start for the actual workflow by forming hypothesis, and then we go and prepare the research design, we measure something, we sample, we collect some data, so we get the rows and columns in our data sheet, and then we process the data and we analyze and interpret. Importantly, the quality of your study is largely determined before you collect the data. So if you collect bad data, then no matter how advanced analysis technique you apply, then it's going to be garbage in, garbage out. So your data should be good, and it's very difficult to recollect the data. So if you do a survey, and then you realize that, okay, I forgot to ask one important question, it's very difficult to go back to the informants and ask again. Sometimes you don't even know who the informants are. Like, for example, if you're collecting data with a survey, and you're distributing your questionnaires in the lobby and asking people to fill them in, unless you ask their mobile phone number or email address, you don't know who those are. We're going to be looking at this part. So the part about research design and starting from hypothesis. Instead of trying to figure out a hypothesis ourselves, we're going to take a hypothesis from a paper that addresses the growth of small companies. And this is from entrepreneurship, and the reason why I'm using this kind of example is that I've been working on the business side of software, and we'll be looking at why certain software companies grow more than others, and this is relevant background research for that research question. So the hypothesis here, first there's a theoretical explanation. What the theoretical explanation is not important, but this guys have a hypothesis that growth motivation at T1, which means time 1, has a positive effect on growth at T2. Why do they have this time 1 and time 2 in the hypothesis? A company's growth motivation at time 1 is associated with growth at time 2. So why is there the time 1 and time 2? In practice, it's two consecutive years. So time 1 could be 2009 and time 2 could be 2010. Why is there this 1 year time lag? Okay, let's take that question up a few slides from now. Let's ask the more general question. How would you test the hypothesis? Growth motivation at time one is associated with growth at time two. So what do we need to do to test the hypothesis? It's basically a hypothesis about correlation. Well, this paper is trying to test the causal claim. They're trying to make a causal claim that it's not just an association, but growth motivation of one of company causes the company to grow. So that those companies that are more growth-oriented, more growth-motivated, will grow more. And that's they're stating a causal claim or explaining why something happens. So the first thing that we have to consider when we ask the question, how would we test this hypothesis, is how do we address the issue of causality? So our hypothesis, growth motivation at time one has a positive effect on growth at time two, we have to now consider three conditions for causality. I'm now asking you the question again, why is there time one and time two in the hypothesis? Okay, three conditions for causality. Is the first one there? Statistical association. Yeah, the hypothesis states that there should be an association. Is the condition two, the cause must precede the effect there? In the hypothesis. Yeah, so we are measuring the cause, the growth motivation, 1 year before the actual growth takes place. So that's the reason why we have time one and time two. We want to rule out that it's actually the growth motivation that causes the company to grow instead of those companies that have grown in the past getting more growth motivated. This paper actually, when you look at the full paper where this hypothesis was taken, they test the directionality as well. Okay, so we have direction of influence because we measure the growth motivation before growth. Then we have to think about alternative explanations. And we have two strategies. We have an experiment where we manipulate the independent variable and then we observe the outcome. For example, some people receive a medicine, others receive a placebo, and then we look at if there's a difference 1 week from taking the real pill and the fake pill. If there is, then we conclude that the real pill and the medicine has an effect. Which strategy can we use to test our hypothesis? Can we manipulate how growth willing some companies are? No, it's not practical. So we can't really manipulate growth willingness. We can't test this on an experimental study. So we have to go for the other alternative, statistical controls. And in statistical controlling, the idea was that we first think, why is there a correlation? And we try to think through alternative explanations for that correlation. So we apply control variables. When the hypothesis is that growth motivation is associated with growth, then we have to ask ourselves, why are some companies more growth motivated than others? So why could some companies be more growth motivated than others? So let's say that you start a plumbing business and you are a plumber and you work as your own business. Those are typically one-man companies, and getting the other guy to work with you would be a big hassle because it involves payroll and stuff like that. It's much easier to be a single guy entrepreneur. Then you have let's say that you have a software startup that wants to be the next Google. So there are different reasons why some companies are more growth willing than others. One is that the company could be in an industry where just there are no growth opportunities that much. So in plumbing, it's not a growth industry. Software at least used to be a growth industry. There are lots of opportunities. So we have to think what kind of alternative explanations there are. We could say that, for example, software companies are more likely to be growth-oriented because of the nature of the industry, and also they're more likely to grow than plumbing companies. So we could have an industry as a control variable. Alternatively, we could control for industry by studying just one industry. I'm going to choose here to study software companies only. And what else could influence growth motivation and growth at the same time? Let's say company's age. When you start a new company, you must be really enthusiastic about it because you have to spend some of your own money, and then you're very optimistic as well. And then once the company grows a bit older, then the reality starts to hit in that it's not that easy to grow to be a large company. So it could be that company's age has an effect on how growth-motivated companies are. We also know from prior research that young companies grow faster than older companies. The reason for that being is that it's easier to grow as a small young company than as a larger company, because, for example, you face more competition when you're a larger company. So company size and company age are natural control variables for this particular hypothesis and the industry, which we control by focusing only on software companies. Then our key variables are growth motivation and growth. So those are the independent variable and the dependent variable. We need to get some data, and to get data, we have to consider the four basic main research designs from Singleton and Straits. So we ruled out experiment. It's not feasible to manipulate how growth-willing some companies are. So we can't use experiment. We can do survey, field research, and archival data. How do we measure growth motivation? Or let's ask, how do we measure growth? Yeah, how do we measure? How do we get data for growth? Turnover and how do we calculate? If we say that Nokia grew 3% last year. Yeah, difference between two consecutive years. Yeah. So if I were to ask you how much Nokia grew last year, where would you get the data? Internet, yeah, but where from the internet? Internet is it's a large place. You could get it from company website, yeah. So many companies publish their growth numbers. Public listed companies have to publish their growth numbers because it's mandated by law. So you could get it from company websites. But that's, if we want to have a sample of 100, that's a lot of work. So what else could we do? Well, there are lots of databases that collect this information for you because revenues is something that every company has to report. Even if you're a single guy entrepreneur, you have to report your revenue for tax purposes. So it's collected by the government, and you could either contact Statistics Finland, which allows you to access the data, or you could contact Asiakastieto or Kauppalehti or whichever database there's available. The list of research databases that we have is available on the university library website. So you can check which database provides information about companies. So we get it from a database. So is it survey, field research, or archival records? Yeah, it's archival records. It's data collected by somebody else. How about growth motivation? Where do we get the growth motivation data? Yeah, we could do a survey because it's not available. So I, as far as I know, no one has published a data set about company growth motivation, and particularly not in Finland. Doing a field research where we go and observe what the companies actually do, if we have 100 companies, that would be impractical. So we can't go and observe each company for a couple of days and then see what we do. For example, organizing access to these companies would be difficult. We can. The easy thing is that we do a survey. We ask the people how growth motivated they are. So we do a survey study. Now that we have decided on that we do an observational study instead of experimental with statistical controls, and we have decided that we use a survey and that we use archival data or database, we have to go to step number two, acquire data. And this data that I use comes from the Finnish Software Industry Survey that I've been running for a couple of years, and that now is we are planning it this fall as well. So we ask all Finnish software companies to fill in a questionnaire, and there we have 8 questions about growth motivation there. They get a paper form, and they get to answer on the internet. And then I'm using this Orbis database to get the growth figures. So I'm not sure if it's available here, but you have other databases that provide the exact same information. The first question when we do a survey data is, how much data do I need? So there are about 5,000 software companies in Finland. Do I send an invitation to every company? That's a cost issue, because sending an envelope with a survey form costs about 1 euro. So if I send them all, it's going to cost me 5,000 euros. If I'm okay with just 500 companies, then I would save 4,500 euros, which is a substantial amount of money, particularly if you have to pay it for yourself. So how much data do I need? I would say that the rule of thumb for regression analysis is that if you have 100 observations, then that's going to be at least good enough for your master's thesis. Sometimes people plan to have 100 responses and they only get 30 or 50 for a master's thesis. Then for master's thesis, you have what you have. So you have 30 respondents, you conclude the data collection didn't succeed as well as you could. It could have, but it's not feasible, and it's not fair for us to ask you as a master's thesis worker to repeat your surveys. Then you just work with what you have. Typically, when you write a survey to companies, your response rate will be about 10%. If we do a large project, we can get up to 25% with certain techniques. But it's getting the responses is going to cost us some money, because we have to do some reminders and call companies and such. If you just send an invitation, then 1 out of 10 will typically respond. Response rate itself is not very important. The important things are, do you have enough data? And also, is there some kind of systematic reason why some companies respond and others don't, which could create problems for you. So the task in a survey is that we first compile the sample. So we have to decide, we have to get addresses, either email addresses or postal addresses for the companies. Postal addresses is easy, because every company in Finland is required to have a mailing address, because government emails them tax information, registration information, so you have to have an address. But companies actually don't have to have email addresses. And those are not systematically recorded by the government. So emails is more difficult. Either you have to pay a lot for a commercial company to provide you the addresses, or you have to collect them manually from the company websites, and maybe some databases contain this information for you. Then we design the survey. So we think, what do we want to ask? Then we send out the questionnaire, and for a master's thesis, you send out the questionnaire, you collect the responses, and then you have some data. For a real research project, we typically send out the questionnaire, then we remind the companies a couple of times that the survey is now on, we would really appreciate your response, and then at the end, we choose some of the most important companies, and we call them and ask them whether they would like to participate. So there can be different levels of effort that go to survey administrators, and depending on what's your goal. Data analysis, you clean the data, and then you start doing other analysis. Important parts about survey is that you should plan well before executing, because if you forget to ask something, then it's nearly impossible to ask it again. So it's easy to add a question to a questionnaire before you send it out. After you send it out, it's very labor-intensive to get the one additional question. Then allow enough time to respond. If someone sends me an invitation that I would need your response to this survey by this Friday, unless they have a very good reason for asking the question in such short time frame, I'm going to ask them. I'm going to email them back and say that read a basic book about survey design, because you should really allow me at least 2 or 3 weeks to respond. I would like to participate, but this time frame is impossible for me. When I do a survey study of companies, I allow them about 1.5 months to respond. And I remind them after 2 weeks and then after 4 weeks of the start. So every 2 weeks, and then at the end they have still 2 weeks time to complete. But it also depends on your own schedule. Sometimes if there is some really acute thing, like for example when Nokia decided to sell their phone business to Microsoft, I received a survey asking, what do you think about this? And I had 2 days time to respond, because the researchers say that they want to have the study result out in a week, because this is now such a timely issue. So that kind of, if you have a specific reason to have a shorter time frame, then that's okay. Then we need to measure growth willingness, and I'm using this kind of scale. So this is something that I developed myself. I first thought about conceptually, what does it mean for a company to be growth willing in the software business context? So I went through the conceptualization process that Singleton and Straits explain in the book chapter that I gave you. And we brainstormed and we read the relevant research literature with my colleagues, and we decided that growth willing companies should at least say that they're growth willing. They should be tolerating some risk, because if you don't take risk, then you don't grow. And risk-taking could be quantified, for example, by asking, is it more important that your company is profitable now or that you grow now? Also, in relation to the growth willingness, we read the literature, and in small companies, it's important that the management are personally invested in their growth willingness. So we asked whether company growth is an important personal objective for the managers. Finally, we asked about international growth, because Finnish software market is such small. If you want to grow a lot, you have to expand internationally. So we decided that our construct growth willingness in this particular context has 3 dimensions. Okay, then we sent out the surveys. We waited for a couple of months, and we got some data. So we have some data, and this survey was repeated for 3 or 4 years, so we have longitudinal data. We can see how things develop over time. So we enter step 3, construct a database. And constructing a database is something that we call when we have to combine different data sets. So we have survey data sets. We did the survey for 4 years, so we have 4 different Excel sheets from there. And we have 1 Excel sheet from the database that contains the financial information. So constructing database, you may have something that looks like 4 different Excel files, and you need to have 1 Excel file or 1 data file for your final analysis. And so what do you do? How do you merge different data sets? You have 5 different Excel files, and you need to merge information from those Excel files. We need to, first of all, match the company responses to the company financial information. We have the company code identifiers for all companies, so we can do matching based on that. So how do you, if I were to ask you to merge 5 different Excel sheets, so how would you do? Well, I gave this as an assignment on one class to a set of students, and they came up with this kind of Excel formula to merge the five data sets. And I read through the formula, I have no idea what it does. So you can do this kind of data merging and with Excel, but the problems are that unless you wrote that forksheet equation yourself, you're not going to understand what it does. And even if you wrote it yourself, it's very difficult to verify that it produces the correct result. So if you have a typo there, then it's difficult to find the typo. If the typo doesn't produce an error message in Excel, it will go unnoticed. A better strategy if you want to be a professional researcher is to either use your statistical software's tools. You can merge data sets in SPSS. And in this particular slide, I have this data and R code that does the merge. So we are basically loading data sets here. We are putting the data sets one after another, and then we are merging the data sets. And that's the same in R. So it's a couple of commands, and you can do this kind of data processing. What makes this approach better is that it shows you step by step what is being done, instead of this one where it's very difficult to follow the logic. And here you can also write comments, but this is a bad example because I don't have any. So we're done with merging our different Excel sheets, our different data sets, into one data file that we can load into our statistical software. So you can always have just one file that you analyze. Then we move to step four. We explore, filter, and transform data. That's an important part because you have to understand your data set. If you don't understand your data set, understand what are the means and standard deviation and ranges of different variables, then it's very difficult to work with that data. So what I do here, I have, by the way, I prepared these files for you if you want to take a look at it later on. So what I do is that, first of all, I check the histogram of the growth. And I can see here that our revenue, I have most companies are below 1 billion euros. And there are some companies that are more than 2 billion euros. Why do we have this kind of distribution? So most companies are, nearly all companies are here, less than 1 billion euros, and some companies are here, more than 2 billion euros. Well, it turns out that we have lots of small companies, but we also have Tieto, which is a 10 billion euro business. And Tieto decided to respond in this study. So they are more than 10 billion. Tieto is here, others are here. So to take this kind of issue into account, that the distribution is very skewed, we can take a logarithm of revenue. So logarithm is quite often used when we want to make data more evenly distributed. So many things are such that we have a natural 0 point, so a company can't have a negative revenue. Then we have a few very small companies, and then we have some larger ones. So taking a logarithm will make the data easier to analyze. Also, I look at the minimums and maximums. Then once I have done these descriptive statistics, the most important being the histogram, my next focus will be correlation. So I first look at each individual variable. What is the maximum? What is the minimum? What is the standard deviation? Is it very skewed? So some small, large values, most values are small, and such. Then I will move on to bivariate statistics. So statistics involving two variables, basically I look at the correlations. What I typically do when I look at correlations is that I don't look at the correlations themselves. Instead, I do something called a scatterplot matrix, which is available in all this software. And scatterplot, I'll show you a subset of that figure next. A scatterplot is a plot where you have one variable on x-axis and one on y, and then it shows you all the observations. So it shows you graphically how two variables are related, and scatterplot matrix is a matrix of these plots containing all your study variables. So this is readable if you have a large high-resolution screen, but here it's not readable, so we'll just focus on a subset of it. So we have here, we have the eight questions about growth willingness, and then we have one-year growth. What we're looking here is that are the growth willingness indicators correlate with one another? The logic was that if two variables or indicators correlate strongly together, then they may measure the same thing. We can see here that there is a negative relationship here, a positive relationship here, and then we can check if these are related to growth motivation. We can see that there are some outliers, but there is no really large relationships. So we explore the data in different ways. Then we start to construct the actual variables that we're going to be using in our analysis. So we had eight questions about growth willingness. We had three questions about general growth willingness, two questions about risk-taking, and three questions about international growth. For regression analysis, to test our hypothesis, the hypothesis was that there is a statistical association between growth motivation and growth. We have to somehow either decide which of these variables we're going to be using in a regression analysis, or we have to somehow summarize these variables. The way we typically summarize variables is that we just take a mean or a sum of different indicators that are supposed to measure the same thing. I'm going to be taking the sum of these three general growth orientation or growth motivation items and use that in my regression analysis. The idea of taking a sum was that when we have some observed data, some variables that we actually have data for, then those variables are a product of two different things. We have the concept that we're measuring. Sometimes we use the word construct in research, but it's the same as concept. And then we have some measurement error that is contaminating our data. When we work, we want to aggregate or combine different measures into a sum. We have to do two things. The first thing that we have to do is to do a factor analysis. So factor analysis allows us to assess which indicators correlate together. And the idea is that if we have eight indicators that are supposed to measure three different dimensions of growth motivation, the factor analysis tells us, are the correlations in that data, do they support the idea that these eight measures measure three different things? So I do that with data, and I'm going to be using exploratory factor analysis because it's easier to apply, and that's what I recommend for you. So Stata gives me something that looks like that. My Stata colors are a bit weird for historical reasons. And important parts here is that I have rotated the factor solution. You don't have to understand what it is. You just have to remember that it has to be done, and you have to use the oblique option here. Then I'm showing only those factor loadings, how factor loading quantifies how strongly each indicator is associated with one factor. So I want to have these growth orientation items, general items, to load on one factor, and then international items loading on another factor. And that's what my result shows. I have eliminated the risk items because from a previous factor analysis, I concluded that they really didn't work at all. So I'm focusing now on two dimensions as candidates of what I'm going to be using in my sums. Typically, this factor loading must be, or it's good if it's more than 0.7 in absolute value. And these smaller loadings should be less than 0.4, less than 0.2, depending on who you ask. I have chosen to not display small factor loadings just to see the pattern. So that is evidence for these three general growth motivation items to measure one thing, and these international items to measure another thing. So So that's evidence of what we call convergent and discriminant validity. When you look at an actual paper, how would this analysis be reported in an actual paper? You can report this correlation, this factor loading table, which is presented as an appendix in the Venkatesh paper. And then in the Venkatesh paper, they report that they did factor analysis with oblimin rotation, so it's oblique, and that's important. And they report that all factor loadings, those were the statistics shown on the previous slide, were more than 0.7. So that's what we want to see, and that's what we saw in the example as well. Okay, it has been established that our scale, the risk indicators, don't work. I don't show you the factor analysis, but the international growth and general growth motivation items do work. So they measure the same thing. The three growth general items measure one thing, and international items measure another thing. Then we have to address the question of reliability. So reliability was whether our results would be the same if we repeat the study over. So it's the degree of random noise in our data, because everything in our data, in our analysis project, is going to be completely deterministic, because computer does it for us. So reliability, the idea was that we triangulate. So if we take multiple unreliable measures, then we can check if they correlate highly, then they are reliable. If they don't correlate highly, then they are not that reliable. When we take a sum or average of multiple unreliable measures, we get a more reliable composite measure. So for example, if you have a wiggling child that doesn't want to be weighted, you weight her 5 times, you take an average, and then each one of those are unreliabilities or random noise that the child causes when she wiggles, they cancel out in the long run. So that's the idea. We quantify reliability using Cronbach's alpha. And how you calculate Cronbach's alpha is that with your statistical software, you just specify statistics and then from the menu, Cronbach's alpha or reliability, whatever it's called. So you just choose it there, choose the items or variables that you want to calculate alpha for, and then we get the result that for these general items, three items, we have Cronbach's alpha 0.88. Typically, you want it to be more than 0.7. Then we would report this Cronbach's alpha in our paper in the following manner. So we say that Cronbach's alphas are more than 0.7. So that's how we would report it. Then you would report the specific values for each scale consisting of multiple items, either in an appendix if you're working on a research paper. If you're working on a master's thesis, then you have plenty of space, so you can report those in the main text. So we do factor analysis, we calculate Cronbach's alphas, and then we can say that we have valid and reliable measures after taking a sum of separate indicators that are supposed to be measuring the same thing. So we take a sum of the growth motivation items, the three first, that are supposed to measure general growth willingness, and then we move on to the next step in the analysis project. So we do descriptive statistics analysis. The idea of descriptive statistics analysis is that we calculate from those variables that will be used in a regression analysis. We calculate correlations, means and standard deviation. So just descriptive univariate and bivariate relationships. In the Venkatesh paper, they have this big correlation table. And this is a bit, so this contains the correlations because correlation table is symmetric. The correlation is going to be the same regardless of whether the variables are on the column and row or row and column. So they have two samples on booking services and government websites, and this upper triangle here is one correlation table, and this is another correlation table. Typically, all this would be blank, and you would just have one sample here, because we normally just present one sample in one study, but they have two. The important thing about the correlation table and means and standard deviations is to go through the information provided and check whether it makes sense. So if we have revenue, then the minimum revenue, for example, should be positive or zero, because revenue can't be negative. So we're looking for data entry mistakes even in this point. Then we look whether the correlations make sense. So if we have growth motivation and growth, then they should be correlated. Let's look at the correlations of our data. So here for the final analysis, I've calculated two growth variables. I have growth over 1 year and growth over 3 years, because 1 year is subject to random fluctuations a lot more than 3 year growth. Then I have age, and I have taken a logarithm of age, because most companies are young, but there are some that are very old in the software industry. I've taken a logarithm of revenue because some companies are very large, most are in the few millions range. Then I have taken the revenue logarithm of profit for the same reason as I've taken a logarithm of revenue. And then we have the growth motivation as the final independent variable. So these two are our dependent variables. We're going to have one set of regressions for one, another set for another. And these are our control variables, and that's our interesting variable. So we first look, do the correlations make sense? So does it make sense that growth over 1 year is correlated strongly with growth over 3 years? Yeah, because they're calculated from the same data. Does it make sense that our companies are age and revenue are correlated positively? If you are a growing company, the more time you've had to grow, the larger you are. So that's the logic. So we go through all these companies, and then importantly, we look at whether growth motivation correlates with the actual growth numbers. So positive but small correlation, we have a higher correlation for three-year growth. So we look at whether they make sense, if there are some large values that should not be there, whether there are some correlations that should be there but are not, then we try to think why would that be the case. Then we go to step 7, the main analysis. And the main analysis is typically some kind of regression model. My rule of thumb is to always start with the basic regression model that I've been discussing the last time. And the reason for that is that even if it's not the exact ideal analysis for your data, then even in that case, it will still provide you some kind of information that you didn't know. And also, it's very quick and easy to apply compared to some other techniques. Then we do at least two models. So we have control variables, and then we have control variables and the interesting variables. We want to show that the interesting variables, the growth motivation in this case, explain the dependent variable more than the controls only. Then we do diagnostics for the models. And once we have done the diagnostics, if we identify a potential problem in the data, such as an outlier, then we fix that, and then we move on to reporting. Typically, we need to do multiple models, and typically we need to do multiple iterations of our models to get all the issues fixed. So data are hardly ever ideal in the first run, so then you do some fixes. So the idea of regression analysis was that from the CEO gender and profitability example, the gender and profitability are correlated, so this area is the correlation. And regression analysis tells us how much of that correlation remains when we take away the effect of a third variable, company size, for example. So regression analysis kind of like takes a control variable size, by the way, tells us how much this correlation remains after we take one alternate explanation into consideration. And of course, we can have multiple control variables, and then we control for, let's say, four or five different things, and then how much of the correlation remains. If there is correlation that remains, then we conclude that the hypothesis is supported. Graphical illustration of regression analysis. Regression analysis for two-variable case, one dependent variable, one independent variable. It draws a line inside a computer memory through the middle of the data. And regression analysis assumes that there are observations, what we call it error term. It should be they should be normally distributed around the line, and the width of this distribution should be the same. So the companies here should be as close to the regression line as the companies here. Okay, so we do regression analysis. We point and click to the statistics menu and then choose regression analysis. Or we in Stata or R, we type regress. And we get some kind of result. So we have a regression analysis of growth on these contour variables and some industry codes because we have that variable as well. What we get is regression coefficients. And because these are the things that we control for, we are not that interested in the actual which one of our control variables influences the result. We are more interested in how much the controls together explain the dependent variable. So we look at the R-square statistic. So we have 1 year growth here, and we explain R-square is 0.03. So the controls explain 3% of the variation of the dependent variable. Normally, if you have about 10% explanation in this kind of studies, that's pretty good. So 3% is on a low side, but there's still something going on in the data. We can also check that the p-values reported here are revenue statistically significant and negative. So the larger you are, the less you're going to be growing relatively. That makes a lot of sense because it's easier to add relatively more to a small number than to add relatively more to a large number. So going from 1,000 to 200, 2,000 euros of revenue, it's much easier than going from 1 million to 2 million or 1 billion to 2 billion. So that's the reason why we have this negative effect here. Then we have the coefficients that we're not very interested in at this point. Then we summarize the tables and the models. I've been running four regression models. I have one set here for 1 year growth. I have another set here for 3 year growth. And this is the controls only. This is the controls and the growth motivation. And we compare which one of these models is better. We explain, with 1 year growth, we explain 4.7%. And 3 year growth, we explain 5.1. So I conclude that this model, 3 year growth, can be explained better with growth motivation. Then I compare the R square of the controls only, which is 3.5%, and this with controls and interesting variables, which is 5.1%. I conclude that after the controls, growth motivation explains about 1.6% of the variation in the growth. So it's statistically significant and a positive effect, but it's fairly small. So that's the interpretation. We have, again, the regression coefficients and model indices here. So this contains the tabular four models table contains about the same information as the previous slide that showed just one of those. Then after I have done one set of models, I do the diagnostics. So I want to know whether regression analysis is an adequate technique for these data. So I go to the diagnostics for the analysis. And to do diagnostics, I have to do plots. I'll show you the plots for the data. And regression analysis makes 6 assumptions, out of which 3 can be tested empirically. We can test whether relationships are linear. So we can actually plot this kind of line diagrams and see if the line is adequate in explaining the data. And we can check if error terms equal variance, which means that the cases are about equally far from the regression line, regardless on where they are in the line, and that they're normally distributed. So those can be checked. And also, we do the outlier check. So outlier was a value that will influence the results heavily. For example, if we have one outlier here, this is the occupations, the data, education, and prestige. One value that is very different from others will have a large influence on where the regression analysis goes. So it kind of like pulls the regression line down, or it can also pull it up if the outlier was here or perhaps here. To do diagnostics, I will do residual versus fitted plot. So the fitted value of a regression analysis is that regression analysis are calculated a prediction. So what is a predicted growth for each company, given their industry, their size, their age, and their growth motivation? So we calculate these predictions, and then we calculate the difference between the predicted value, which is on the regression line, and the observed value, which is the residual. And then we plot them. And we can see here that if we were to explain how this data goes, we can see that it spreads out here. So the observations are not equally spread around the regression line. So that's a problem. Also, we can see that it kind of curves up a bit here. So we may have some, we have a problem of at least the assumption that the observations would be equally spread around the regression line and that the line is the best description of the data. When we are facing with this kind of analysis, this kind of plot, we have a couple of things. Either we change our model or our data, or we could be looking at if these two cases that are way far from the regression line are actually outliers. So we are looking at whether there's a reason for those companies to not be in our sample. Could it be that they are data entry mistakes? Could it be that it's a merger of two companies, so it's not very representative of all companies? That kind of reason. So we look at case by case. And I've been looking at three-year growth, and one good idea when you see this kind of that it spreads out is to just look at, okay, let's look at how is the three-year growth itself distributed. So we can see here that there are some companies, most companies don't grow at all, and some companies grow a lot. So most are here, then some are here, and that's very far from normal. And when we have this kind of distribution, quite often we take a logarithm. So and to do that, we get a nicer spread. There's still this long tail, but I'm taking a logarithm based on this plot just to get the cases spread out more evenly on the variable. So we do a logarithm transformation. We can then do the regression models again. So we get the table. Previously, we explained 5.1% of the dependent variable. Now we explain 7.1%. So the model is better in that regard. The difference between the controls only is 4% to 7%. It's 3.1%. So it's twice as good explanation as it was in the previous when it was 1.6% difference. Then the next step, we do the diagnostics again, and I'll be looking next at the residuals. So we can see here residuals is the blue. We can see that there's some companies still that have a growth that is a lot higher than what the model would predict them to have. And then we have some, we don't have this long tail here. So that's potentially a problem, and we have to identify why some cases are not explained well by the data, by the model. We can also do an outlier plot, so out leverage and residual. This is a plot that tells how far from the mass center the observation are. So if they're far, then they have lots of leverage on where the residual go, where the regression line goes. So we'll identify what these cases are. And then we decide on whether to take them out. Or we can plot the data. So we can have a residual, and then we can have each variable at a time. And now we can identify that these large residuals here are associated with revenue. So there are some small companies, revenue is small here, that have large residuals. So we know that these large residuals, which are problematic, are related to company size. Okay, so the analysis tells us that we should be looking at the small companies next. So we want to see, okay, how is revenue divided, distributed? We'll take summary statistics of revenue to identify how is that distributed. And we can see that there are median revenue is 300,000 euros. So that's a two-man company, basically, because you have to pay all the employer expenses and taxes. So these companies are very, very small. We have 25% of the companies make less than 93,000 euros per month of year per revenue. If you make 100,000 euros of revenue, then you are basically a self-sustaining business. Because if you make 100,000 euros of revenue, then after all taxes and expenses, even if you work at home, you'll have a salary of 50,000 euros per year. And that's basically, that's probably something that a university-educated person could be satisfied with. So these companies that make 25,000 or 8,000 are probably not full-time enterprises. It could be that there is someone who is freelance programming. It could be a student developing something for the App Store on his or her free time. And there are the single entrepreneur companies that probably they work a bit differently than business organizations. So we probably want to remove all companies that make less than 100,000 euros of revenue per year. When we take those companies away, we redo our regression models. We can see that the R square for the main model is up from 7% to 7.8%. The difference between controls only and the actual model is about 2 percentage points or 2.2. Then we do diagnostics. After eliminating the smallest companies, our residuals are, we still have some larger residuals, but it's closer to being normally distributed. And this is something that at least I could live with, and I could confidently publish that this is a good data set. Then we can look at the residuals and residuals versus each variable. So we can still see that the residual for smaller companies is more spread out than for larger companies. We have statistical techniques that take that into account, and but we don't really cover that on this course. If you want to use regression analysis and you have that kind of shape, then ask your supervisor what to do about it. There are good remedies for that problem. So we have now a set of regression results in a table of four models, three-year growth, controls only, and interesting variables and controls, and then for 1 and 3 years. Then we move on to the supporting analysis because we are satisfied with the analysis. Important things about supporting analysis for this particular research question is our sample representative of the population? If we are saying in our survey form that we're studying the growth motivation and its effect on growth, do you think that those companies that are growth motivated are more likely to respond to our survey than those who are not? Probably. So we have to assess whether the sample is representative of the population. What we can do is that we, of course, don't have data on the growth motivation of those companies who didn't answer our survey, but we have the revenue data. So we can compare those data that we have against the respondents versus the full population or full whoever we send out the invitation to, and that will allow us to assess selection effect. Then we can do internal validity checks or robustness checks. We can check, okay, does the effect hold for companies less than 10 years? Does it hold for companies more than 10 years? So we can do this kind of subsample analysis. That's another very common way of supporting analysis. After you have done all this, gone through the process of analyzing the data, you have the correlation table, and you have the regression models in the table, then you just write what you did, and you're done with your master's thesis. Writing is then very easy, because if you have done everything this far correctly. Then I have a couple of things that I want to say about quantitative research in general. And the key questions in quantitative research is, first, what do you want to say with the numbers? So what's your objective? Typically, the objective is to make a causal claim or explain something. Then we need to decide, what do I need to observe? So I'm going to study companies. Okay, which companies? And what do I need to measure? So what are the important things? Growth motivation, growth, for example. What are the most important alternative explanations for that correlation? Then that relates to what relationships I'm interested in. after we have an initial idea, then we start to think, okay, is there something that that could go wrong? Then we choose the design. Is it going to be an experiment? Is it going to be a survey, a field study, or can we get data collected by somebody else? After we have the data, then there's the question of which analysis to use. I generally recommend that you start with regression analysis because that's close enough to the good solution, at least, in most cases. Another thing is that you take a good book. For example, Ketokivi's book is great in Finnish, and there are others as well. And you check what does the book recommend, and then you apply that technique. Or you can check your user manual of your software. What does the user manual recommend for this particular scenario? Then you should think about the theoretical process, like why are some companies more profitable than others instead of what their data looks like. Then you choose the simplest possible thing to do, and then you do with that. The reason for going with simple things is that if you have a simple thing that is good enough, and you have a complex thing that is nearly perfect, the odds for you applying the simple thing correctly are a lot higher than the odds for you applying the complex thing correctly. And it's a good trade-off to know that you applied something that is slightly less optimal correctly than to apply something that you're not quite sure if you applied it correctly, because the result could be very misleading. All analysis techniques are used exactly the same way. So you get some kind of regression coefficients that quantify the effect of each variable on the one dependent variable. So typically we have just one dependent variable. Then you compare model fit, regardless of which technique you use, how much does the model actually explain. Then you do model comparisons, controls only versus the controls are interesting. Then you do diagnostics. Typically you look at which cases does the model explain well, which ones it doesn't, and then you look at the residuals, which quantify the degree to which the model doesn't predict each individual case well. And then finally, you look at the regression coefficients, you look at the R-square, and then is it a large effect or not? Then you do the two tables, and then you're basically done. Important things about quantitative research, what determines the quality is first the reliability, the degree of random error. Validity, do your indicators or variables actually measure the things that you're supposed to measure? The tools that we use to assess these two are convex alpha and factor analysis. Then statistical conclusion validity, have you applied your statistical techniques correctly, and have correct techniques been used in your study? Internal conclusion validity or internal validity refers to whether the statistical associations that you have found correctly are actual causal relationships. To address that, you either have to have an experimental design, or your control variables must be well chosen. Then external validity, finally, is whether your results generalize to other populations. And that is something that you can't demonstrate statistically because you don't have access to the other populations. It is just something that you, as a researcher, judge. For example, if we're studying the growth of bakeries in eastern Finland, it's probably not a good idea to generalize to multinational corporations in China. Probably not externally valid generalizations. If we are studying the growth of bakeries in eastern Finland, we could probably generalize to small non-technology businesses in Finland. So that's to which extent do your results generalize. And that was my final slide in this set, so we can have discussions and conclusions. And I'll send you an email, and if there's enough interest, we could have one questions and answer sessions after all these lectures. And if there's enough interest and if we can work out the time, then that can be arranged. You can go for lunch or you can ask questions.